Lundy. I'm a psychologist, and what we're going to talk about today is romance and frustration in relationships. There's another title on the paper for you, and it's The Interpersonal Seesaw, Love and Hatred Between Opposite Personality Types, because that's the description of my own marriage, and I thought I'd share that with you this morning. But the nice thing is, come to Bible study, please, because Doug Kinnick talked this morning about his love affair with his wife and his dog, and we're going to use his wife as an illustration instead of mine. So that's an advantage for us. I want to start with something that doesn't have to do with this seemingly, but just a little overview, and some of you have heard this before, and just bear with me. There's an important model of human awareness that I want to share with you. It's a model that we use in our clinic, in our inpatient clinic, in our outpatient clinic. And it's a complex model, but the reason it's useful is it keeps us from making simplistic statements or simplistic judgments about human experience. And that's one of the most common errors in analyzing ourselves and in analyzing others and even in understanding our children. I want to suggest that you think about your human awareness right now, if you just think about who you are or try to get in touch with what's going on in you, as having a thought component, a feeling component, and one that I don't focus on much because this is a physiological component, one of sensation. In other words, the warmth of your skin or the coolness of it, the way it feels sitting in a cushion chair or one of the hard chairs, that would be a sensation. But your human awareness is made up of thoughts, feelings, and sensations. And they affect each other back and forth all the time. But beyond that, there's four other factors that simultaneously cause you to think and feel and experience sensations, except you don't know which avenue or which one of these four roads is affecting you, and that's the road of your biological or genetic self. And so someone this morning might even have a cold physiological sensation that would be coming from a hypothyroid condition. But they might think it's because they were frustrated with their kid. But you see, you have to figure out which avenue it's coming from. So we have a biological self, we have a self that's been influenced by our environment and our culture, we have spirituality and values, and you have a psychological self with your personal history. All four of those parts of you or aspects flow simultaneously into your human awareness and create your own consciousness that you're aware of today. And the one thing I would suggest is that the balance between thoughts and feelings, what I think, my mental formulations, I like you, I don't like you, or whatever, and my feelings, I feel comfortable, I feel anxious, I feel joyful. I would suggest to you that your feelings are 80% of your day-to-day business of doing life. And although I have the self-perception of making 80 to 90% of my choices out of my thinking self, I think that when I get more aware of who I am, I realize that I'm making more like 80% of my choices and interactions out of my feeling self. And our feeling self is not always as available to us. It's sometimes a little bit underground or out in the shadows. And so it takes more effort to become aware of the feelings that may be leading me to make the decisions or the interactions that I'm making. Now, this is an important model because when we talk today about relationships, what I'm really going to be talking about is ourselves as individuals. Not so much the marriage dynamic, but I come from a point of view that would really say that my contentment in marriage is by and large an individual issue as opposed to a relationship issue. And we have to start with ourselves as individuals and approach our marriage that way rather than starting with the other or even with the interaction between myself and the other. How many of you have recently seen anybody in new love? or can remember that far back. Goodness sakes.
Can I just ask a question,
yeah.
Jim? When you say 80% of our day is feelings,
80%.
Would you say that generally for all people? I mean, would it vary for, I mean, because I would say my husband doesn't react that way. Did you say that? Do you, I mean, can we have this little dialogue here?
Please do.
We're not sitting close enough, so I'd like to know what you feel about that.
Or 80% of the energy in us, or another way to say it is when I make a decision, there's no way to measure this, so I'm talking about propensity here, I'm not talking about something that we could measure, but if I make a decision to live on a hill or live in the valley, that although I may have a lot of thoughts about why I make that choice, I'm suggesting that 80% of the energy in that choice comes from a feeling component.
Jim, I like to think of thoughts preceding almost all feelings. So what we think is what leads to our feelings. And so Are you saying that there's hardly any thoughts that we have that don't result in feelings that then result in behavior? We don't leave the feeling out very often and go directly from thoughts to behavior. Is that?
We have well-trained therapists in the audience, so please keep me on task here. One clear model of feelings in psychology is that thoughts precede feelings and actually form the feeling, and then that we make our behavioral choices off of the feelings. I'm presenting a little different model here today, that we have leftover feelings from our childhood development that live in us independent of my conscious thought pattern.
Okay.
So I wouldn't disagree with you at all. There's clearly an ongoing interaction between thoughts and feelings all the time. A nice illustration of that is if you heard the fire alarm go off in this room. Immediately you have a thought, fire, followed by a feeling, followed by action, we're going to get out of here. That would be a way that a thought would produce a feeling. Or if you were going on an overnight camp out tonight and you got up this morning and you saw the clouds inside, you would say, if you wanted it to be a sunny day, oh, this is, I'm feeling a little sad about this. Another way in which a thought would produce a direct feeling. But also I would suggest to you that we have a feeling world that is independent of our conscious thinking. And just throw that out for your consideration today as we work through this material. And I think that in romance, we see that. I don't do premarital counseling because for people who've never been married, who are 19, who are utterly in love, and who are planning about how wonderful their life's going to be, because I've never been able to do it well. If you know how, let me know. Premarital counseling in my office works well with people who have a history in marriage or relationships, who know that even though they feel wonderful, that there's a new day ahead where they're not going to feel. And typically, and we could spend the next hour with illustrations of people who have fallen out of love literally within 1 to 5 hours after the marriage ceremony. I have lots of illustrations of people weeping on airplanes on the way to Hawaii because they realized after the concrete exchange of vows that this is different than I thought it was or that I felt it was. And so that's what we're in a sense talking about.
Maybe marriage should be like a contract that doesn't take effect for 24 hours. Or 24 hours to back out of it with no experience.
That, that's a good point. Is there a way to design the marriage contract so that you can get past the romance phase and see if it's what you want? And one of the interesting things is we're very sure that living together has no correlation with success in marriage. So even that trial run does not impact successful selection of a life partner.
There's no strings.
Yeah, there's no strings. In fact, in the living together situation, as it's analyzed by secular psychologists, it's abusive to women. Because the man maintains the same amount of freedom he had before, he maintains his economic independence, and the woman in the relationship takes over the domestic chores, often shares her finances, and is sexually faithful. It's like marriage for a woman and not for a man. Just an interesting aside. Well, let's look at this business of opposites attracting. It might be interesting for you to think about your marriage partner or your children's or so on. I wanted to read a little to you this morning from a book called The Dance of Intimacy. It's in the bookstore. It's a book by a psychoanalytic feminist. It's written to women, but it's equally applicable to men. Excellent book. You might want to look at it. The other material I'll be using today in part is from a book called Getting the Love You Want, A Guide for Couples by Harville Hendricks. It's a national bestseller. You've probably seen this. Very, very good book. You might want to look at that as well. Harriet Lerner talks about dealing with differences. And listen to some of her ideas as an introduction today. It's hard to feel intimate with someone we disagree with. Surely relationships would be calmer and simpler if everyone thought, felt, and reacted exactly as we do. We commonly confuse closeness with sameness and view intimacy as the merging of two separate eyes into one world view. Then she says, some differences are bound to make us feel angry, isolated, and anxious at times, and for this reason it may be hard to keep in mind that differences are the only way we learn. In our world, even our intimate relationships, were comprised only of people identical to ourselves, our personal growth would come to an abrupt halt. Those are depressing words, if we understand them, because it means that in relationships and in personal growth, there's going to be pain and anxiety, and my idea of romance is bliss and good feelings. It's not this business of getting along with somebody different than I am. So she talks about opposites attract, and I would suggest to you very, very directly that opposites do attract. I believe that's a psychological, scientific fact. And she gives a nice illustration here of Susan and John. Differences may draw us like a magnet to the other person. However, these same differences may repel us later on. What initially attracts us and what later becomes the problem are usually one and the same. Like qualities that were the most and least valued in my women's group. And she gives an illustration of a man named John who comes from a tight-knit, close family, and Susan who comes from a laid-back family that values autonomy, and the sooner the kids are out of the nest and on their own, the better we did as parents. And she describes Susan's attitude into the marriage 5 years after the fact. Susan, on her part, was allergic to the distance and superficiality in her own family. She's felt especially drawn to John's large and expressive extended family. But what were her complaints 5 years into their marriage? Susan felt closed in and suffocated by John's demanding family. It's like a big sticky cocoon. And she was mad at John for not cutting the apron strings. I think that, in a nutshell, that's what goes on for all of us in relationships as we grow to maturity. And Harville Hendricks would say in his book that he believes in marriage not for any moral grounds. He has a statement in there that he doesn't have any religious reason or moral reason why anybody should stay married. From your value standpoint, get divorced as often and remarry as you want. But he says, from a personal maturity standpoint, the only way you and I will ever grow up is by staying in one marriage. Because it's in that marriage that we come to face our own need to make up for our own deficiencies rather than continuing to look for somebody out there who will fix me. And particularly for those of us who are men and were raised in a world where we stay connected to women and our mothers and other women, very, very late into our lives, we're often looking for that woman who can take our pain away. Well, let's turn to our outline. And now what I want to do as we talk through this is be interrupted by you just as much as you would be interrupted with questions as much as you would like. Comments, questions, anything. These are the stages of a relationship. Attraction, romantic love, and power struggle. Okay? And we're going to work through these. Let's start with attraction. Have you seen the book, His Needs, Her Needs? Any of you familiar with that book? They talk about what I mean here by level one attractions. And what are the things that women want in men? What kinds of things?
Stability.
What else?
Responsibility.
Honesty. Anything else? Communication. Security. Intimacy.
Respect.
Commitment to home base. Boy, those are good qualities, aren't they? You know, women are sensitive, kind, caring people. Now, what traits do men want at an external level? Good.
Don't say a thing.
The first man that says sex is going to get run out of the room.
Fidelity.
Well, the most attractive thing in this man's list, it's physical attraction and sexuality are the top. And then commitment to the relationship, communication, nurturing, affirmation of the other. And so our externals, our level one needs in relationships are very different. Although out of the list of 10, they're not different, they're just in reverse order. It still makes, yeah, it makes a big difference, you bet. But that's where we start. We start with these level one connections. And that's how we make our initial attraction to each other. A woman will decide a man has the security, the resources, the responsibility, and she comes towards him, and he looks at her and says, you look attractive, you'd make a good sexual partner, you can nurture me, you can affirm me, and we come together. But attraction doesn't make romance, does it? Because there's lots of people who can match at that level that don't fall into romantic love. And so we go on to internal attractions, which is where the romance begins. And now here's where we're talking about feelings that don't come from our current thinking, but feelings that come from our residual past, primarily our early childhood. And I want to suggest something to you that sounds a little off base at first, maybe. But hidden needs from our past provide large amounts of emotional energy for positive and negative feelings. These hidden needs are related to the wounds of our childhood. These needs form the basis of internal attraction to romantic partners. These old parts of ourselves from our childhood form the attraction to the people that we're going to fall romantically in love with. Let me read you about June and Tom. June managed anxiety by overfunctioning, which is typical for her sibling position as the oldest of four daughters. That is, when stress hit, she moved in quickly in an over-responsive fashion to take charge and fix the situation. People who were fond of Jane described her how?
Giving.
Caretaker.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like June. She's my kind of person. Want me to read out, you know. They said she was competent, mature, and reliable. Those who didn't like her called her what?
You get her?
Bossy.
Controlling.
How many oldest children do we have in here?
You're describing the way your siblings called. Those are the names they called you. She's the youngest of six, and I'm the oldest of three, so we make a good pair. Bossy, strict, overly assertive, demanding. This portrait, again, is typical of an oldest child. Tom, however, underfunctioned under stress. He tended to become fuzzy, irresponsible, inviting others to criticize or take over for him. For example, he'd tell June he'd bring the kids home at 6, and Sunday evening he might be there by 6:30. People who liked Tom called him what? Laid back, easygoing, charming, relaxed. Those who weren't his fans said what about
him?
Irresponsible, should grow up,
flaky,
become more reliable, learn to be thoughtful towards others. Tom, in many ways, was a typical youngest child. Now, I don't want to overstate the case, but those are nice illustrations of how we have a feeling self that comes to us from our childhood and still is with us. And that when we experience anxiety, which is conflict or tension, we respond to it in a variety of ways, not all the same. Some people, when they experience anxiety, they get real fuzzy. They just kind of freeze, and that way somebody else will take charge. And someone who's more responsive to anxiety, when they feel it, boy, they just scurry around and take care of everything. And the person who's fuzzy and freezing, they're doing a really good job because they're staying out of this person's way. And what's nice is when you get married and you marry, you're unconsciously or from a feeling self-attracted to someone who's going to balance you. So extroverts find great joy in marrying introverts. And someone who can't relax likes to marry somebody who can. And we find a great balance and a great joy. And we say to this other person, we'll be a team like nobody's ever been a team. And that works great until you did get too close together right after you say, I do. And then you realize that you like this person, but you didn't want them that close. So look at number two. Then what do? What are your relationship problems about? Typically, they're about money, sex, kids, time, and communication. Any others you want to throw into that list? And so what happens is we have two people over here, person A and person B, and in our early days of our marriage, we're always fighting, and sometimes even much later, we're fighting about issues, and we triangle, and we just, if I can get you to think or feel or behave or believe like I do, we'll solve this. And so we put a lot of energy into this. And these are, if you look at it a bit, you'll see that these correlate with level one needs. You know, go to the party and talk this time. Or just stay home and read with me or whatever. And we're negotiating very often at level one issues early in the marriage. And we're just trying to get this worked out. I think there's an important statement here that you might want to hang on to. This is maybe the heart of what we're talking about today. Marriage problems are about issues. Relational or marriage solutions are about resolving personal problems. It doesn't have much to do with...
Say you're fighting about money then. What you're fighting about is the insecurity that you might be poor from a childhood. Is that what you're saying? I'm not quite following.
Or that I still believe that I have to have my way to be happy. Or that you have to be like me to be happy. Or that we both have to want to go to the theater to be happy. Or that somehow we can't be very different people. And there's still this idea of dependency in our relationship, where I'm going to make up the lack in myself through you. And when you are different or opposed or contradictory to me, it drives me nuts. Because I need you to be with me or like me or let me be dependent on you. And you know, one of the most marvelous examples I have is of a 45-year-old man
who told me after his wife went off and went back to school and quit cooking and quit doing the laundry and quit being a good wife, that isn't the point of the story, but that's how we set it up. He then began to cook for himself and the kids and do some laundry and take more charge of his life. And one day, 2 years after that start, he said to me, he said, you know, I've never felt happier as a person in my life. I finally grew up when I learned to take complete care of myself and make relationships with men outside of my marriage so that I didn't put all of the energy for my need meeting on my wife. And I hear that a lot. So it's sometimes it's about unconscious issues related to the money in terms of security and things, but very often it's this ongoing drama of I'm going to get my needs met through another person rather than finishing the business of realizing I can take care of my own needs. Now, I'm not talking about living like an island. I'm talking about connecting to people outside of our marriages, learning that I can meet my own needs, you know, and so on. Good question.
Jim, mm-hmm. What about people who describe their problems as it's a power struggle and each one really wants to be in control of the relationship?
All right.
I can see that probably it's exactly what you're saying, but it sounds different to say that, you know, I want you to be like me.
Mm-hmm.
Just do what I tell you.
Right, which is a subtle form of, you know, if you'll go along with the way I write the script, then I've always got you with me, and I can be so dependent on you, and you provide so much security for me. And that leads right into our next section of romantic love, childhood revisited, and this is where you might want to look on an outline. I want to make this real simple. These are formal developmental stages that I gave to you so that you could have them. I think this should be public knowledge information. There's a lot of kids in the village right now, and just watch them at next meal after reading through this, because they're these beautiful little boys and girls going through these stages. And the first stage is autism. And that's when all the energy goes to the child. The child just takes in all the energy. 0 to 2 months, nobody exists but me. It's a wonderful stage if you're not the mother. It's a great stage if you're the child. Then symbiosis, which is a model for many of the rest of our human interactions. That's you know, maybe 2 to 6 months. This is where we call the vital circular, that should be interaction, not attention, between mother and child. You know how that goes? During this stage, the children's eyesight is focused especially at about 8 inches. I mean, biologically, we're just set for this. The little boy or girl can see 8 inches away, and what's 8 inches away? Mom's face and mom's breast. And it's warm, and it's full of food, and it's wonderful. And the trouble is, we try to do this in marriage. And that's our point down here. Then what happens is that we begin to grow up, leading on to about 2 years. And there's 3 separate phases under that. The first is hatching, and that's a neat phrase. That's why I want to give it to you. You know, that's when the kid breaks out and pushes away from mom and tries new things. And then there's practicing. That's the phase that always tormented me the most as a father. That's when the baby will put the puzzle together and then break it apart. Put it together, break it apart, over and over and over. And then there's another phase called rapprochement, which is important because that's when, as we start to pull away from mom, we get scared. And we go through what's called a regressive pull. We get too far away, so we go back. And now we're in tension. Should I grow up? Or should I go home? And you see, when anxiety hits, many of us want to do what?
Go home.
And that's what creates problems. Then we finish growing up in object constancy, and I don't want to go through that too much more. But what I want to suggest to you is that people like Harriet Lerner and Harville Hendrix are telling us that romantic love is like the symbiotic stage. It reminds us of a time in our lives when we were the center of another person's attention and life was wonderful. Mm-hmm. And think about how you talk to people in romantic love. What do you say? What do you say to them?
Baby talk.
It was wonderful because it was all about this stuff. We talk baby talk. We get about 8 inches from each other. We coo. I've heard 50-year-old men tell me that they sat up all night just looking at the face of their new love. That's scary. but what do you do with your new baby? Go in and you look at them, and they look at you. You see, so we create this. We've tapped in to some old stuff that's in you and I. That says good news. That, you know, help has arrived. Somebody's here to fix me. And I think that's what romantic love is like. Then also remember that in those early days there was push pull and there was tension. And one of the first emotions of little children towards mom and dad is anger. When we set limits on them, when we aren't able to feed, hold, or let them have all their freedom, and that happens to you and I. Look over now, flip the page over, and we'll look at number 4, stages of loss in romantic love. You know, let me say very clearly, egocentricity, romance, falling in love, cooing to each other is not bad. It is not bad. It's a necessary step in maturity. Don't at all label it bad. Don't try to skip it. You know, I'm going to be so mature and aware that when I fall in love with somebody or when my kids do, I'm going to give them this. I give this book to premarital couples. They don't read it.
Too busy looking at each other.
Yeah, they're too busy looking at each other. They read it. It talks about how bummed out marriage can be, and they tell me theirs won't be that way.
It's better for wedding gift.
Yeah, wedding gift. Have them read it on the plane and on the way. You see, it's not bad. We've got to be really clear with that. It's egocentricity. Is a necessary step on the way to maturity. That's why if a child in their human development doesn't get enough love, and we find them now at 19, antisocial, breaking all the rules, they still need love. Because you've got to get that to build the rest on. So we can make jokes about it, and we need to laugh about it in ourselves, or we'll spend too much time crying about it. But we need to understand it's not bad. It's a stage prior to maturity. It's a necessary stage. So enjoy it. But what happens when it ends? And I put on here, this happens when you're 35 to 45 years old, if you're somebody who's typically getting married at 20 to 25. If you get married younger, it'll happen to you sooner. It's just a matter of time and a matter of awareness. What happens first? Shock. This is not the person I thought I married. It's hard to get illustrations of this when you have your spouses with you here today. Would anybody want to get an illustration? Go ahead.
I was shocked. 25 years.
Uh-huh.
So it does happen.
Anybody else want to? Comment about the shock.
Well, it's kind of like a betrayal. Your first experience of it is like a betrayal, like, you know, but it's because of your perception. You know.
Yeah, betrayal's a good word. Mm-hmm. It feels like betrayal. You know, we had a contract. You were like this before we got married. And now you've changed it all. Look at the first little sentence under number four. We get married to meet our needs, not the others. Did you ever say that when you were courting somebody? I'm in this for me. Just want to be really clear with you before I get married. I'm in this for me. I didn't say that. I made a lot of promises I never kept. I think that's what we do. But you know it's true, isn't it? You know it's true. You get married to meet your own needs.
So how should we get married?
That's fine. That's nothing wrong with getting married this way.
Okay, fine.
It's just true. It's just something we don't admit. Who knows this better than parents? When you look at kids selecting marriage partners, what do you think, parents? Oh, great, my daughter can rehabilitate this guy? What do you think? What are you looking for in a marriage partner?
Someone that your child would be happy with, someone that's good for them.
Right. Somebody that's
good for them.
Somebody
to meet their needs.
Yeah.
And somebody to meet their needs. We all know this. You don't ever say it. We say it real carefully at the marriages, you know, boy, John, your daughter sure married a nice man, meaning she did good. Or the other way around, meaning, you know, your child looks like they made a good deal here, that they got somebody that can really meet their needs. You can relax now. You can pass this parenting and security job over to the marriage partner. We all know that's what marriage is about, but we never say it.
That sounds a lot healthier than the other way around, is somebody getting married to fix the other person.
Mm-hmm.
In my first marriage, that was the case.
Mm-hmm.
I thought all she needed was a good man. Which was extremely unhealthy for both
right.
of us.
Right. Yeah, very.
Maybe people who get married again are willing to say, I'm getting married, what is it, to meet my own needs.
Yeah.
I think some of us have experienced that maybe.
Mm-hmm.
We're married a second party.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Well, it seems to me that even if you know it, you better not say it to anybody. even if you say it to your best friend, you know, the word that comes out is selfish. So it's like a big secret that everybody keeps.
Yeah, and that's why I'm suggesting that it's a secret that everybody knows. Uh-huh. But you don't talk about it. Maybe
it's not healthy to talk about it. Why are you saying
that? We're talking about two things. That culturally it's not okay, and that it'll backfire on you. Even your best friend will say, boy, you know, that's no reason to get married.
Okay.
But I'm agreeing clearly with you and that
it is a good reason.
It is a good reason. It is something to think about. But an even better thing is to realize that I have to take care of my own needs, not my marriage partner. And that's the final step of maturity. That it isn't that nobody's going to do it for me. No one person is going to do it for me.
If you, in your mind, say, I'm getting married to meet my own needs, and then for some reason that person doesn't do it, there's major disappointment.
Right.
So that's where the anger and frustration comes in. And if you feel confident that you can meet your own needs and you're getting married because you just like being around this person, then you're putting less responsibility on them. So if they don't necessarily meet your needs, you're not in a state of panic of, what did I do?
If I ever get married again, I'm going to try it that much more. Very few of us do. That's right. Well, so we have shock. Then we have denial. We keep our eyes shut. It hurts too much to open them and see who we marry. So we try to see their negative traits in a positive light. I'll grow through this. I'll mature through this. I'll bring them around. I can overcome their problems. You know, we close our eyes. We pray. We work. We do whatever we do to try to make it work. Anybody want to share an illustration from that phase? You've had the shock. Now you try to make it work. It's a tough time. It's a time when you hear people sometimes giving prayer requests about their marriage partner. You know, God's going to make me a better person through his or her faults, so pray for us.
Or if you're a caretaker, you have a tendency to really go overboard.
Mm-hmm.
You're really going to make this work no matter what.
That's right.
And especially, I think, coming from a Christian background as a woman, like it was just sort of, I know when I married, and the panic set in for about the third day we were married. and it was like, I just assumed that was my role, to be the wife, the mother and stuff, and I just set out to make the best of it and didn't really see any other choices.
Boy, and that is so common in the Christian world, that at that first panic, and it's usually women who go for help, and they're often told what a woman told me a few weeks ago. She was in her 22nd year of marriage when she came in my office the week before we came up here. She said, I went to the pastor 5 years into marriage and told him what was going on, and he said, just work harder at it and it'll work out. And so she went back and spent the next 15 plus years working harder at it and was still in the exact same boat, because she kept focused on him, and that somehow she could just do it right. It had put this whole problem into the right focus.
Even the concept of agape applies into that, because I got caught in the self-denial state.
Yeah, and that's a nice you know, we don't have time for that, but the interaction between agape and what we're talking about, because self-sacrifice, giving love, doesn't mean that we lose our self in the process. And what I would suggest to you is that it takes a self to do agape love, and that if agape destroys myself, that it's not agape. Because Jesus always talked out of the I position, and he always said, I lay it down, nobody takes it from me. And we often get that pretty confused. Well, then we switch to bargaining. You know, we've been shocked, we've tried denial for a while, and then we say, this isn't working. So we go back to level one issues about money, sex, going to the theater, or whatever else is important for you, childcare arrangements, and we say, well, let's just balance the checkbook. If my negative side is as big as yours, and then I can get a few payoffs and you can get a few payoffs, maybe we can tough this thing out. And we put a lot of energy sometimes into the bargaining phase. And usually what happens is that we're happy for a while, and that an old despair creeps up within us, because we know that just having a good contract isn't what we were looking for in relationships. And then we hit despair, and in the United States, 50% goes to divorce, and 50% of the people go into parallel marriages. Not where they've, in a healthy way, decided to meet their needs in other relationships and to let their spouse grow, but sort of a cold war where, you know, I don't like you, and you don't like me, and we don't have the guts to get a divorce. So we're just going to live in this house for the sake of the kids or whoever, and we're not going to like each other, but our friends won't really know it, and let's see if we can get on with life. And that's enormously painful and sad, and it's too bad to get stuck there, but a lot of folks do. Well, let's look at these, what we call here the healing responses. The first one is to realize that our love relationship has a hidden purpose, the healing of my childhood wounds. And that's a tough thing to admit, that in this marriage, one of the things I really wanted was to get some things in me taken care of, and I was attracted to you because it looked like you could do that, and then you didn't do it. So under number B, we then begin to create a more accurate image of our partner than we've developed during romantic love, because if during romantic love we were both putting into this pot and we thought it was going to be full of riches and goodness for both of us, then we got married and we both reached to take out and realized we could be enemies at that point. Now that I've realized that I got married so that you would put something into me, if I quit looking at you like that, I have to see it through new eyes. Who are you anyway? What kind of a person are you? And let me just take a little aside and suggest that this relationship can happen between pastors and churches. The new pastor comes, there's a romantic bond, you're going to be everything we never had, and then you're not, and now the church and the board has to, the pastor and the church board sit down and look at each other and decide who we really are. This happens in lots of relationships where we project our needs onto other people. And then we're disappointed, and we have to sit down and learn to know the other person. Can anybody take a moment and share some things they discovered in their marriage or relationship partner that they didn't know at the point of the marriage, some new things that they discovered over the course of their relationship that they didn't maybe they didn't even want to know this about the person in their first It's a real nice phase of reconciliation where we begin to appreciate the other person in entirely. It has happened. I'm sure it's happened. Think of that.
Well, for me, the real significant things would involve a betrayal of trust, because the real significant things are very vulnerable. And so for me to share particulars about that would be a real betrayal of trust. That's where I'm coming from.
That's fine. For some people, would be very intimate. For others, it would be more concrete. Even the awareness that their marriage partner wanted to have a career. That might have been a whole new eye-opening experience for somebody in a marriage. That they, sure, he or she went to college and had a degree and had a career, but boy, I thought getting married was just going to turn all their attention on me. I didn't know they really wanted to pursue a graduate degree. That's fairly surface, but in some marriages, that's brand new eye-opening awareness. It's been there all the time, but something that we looked away from. Okay, number C, take responsibility for knowing and communicating our own needs at level 1 and 2. Beginning to say, this is who I am, this is what I want, this is what I feel. You don't have to read my mind, I'll tell you, and I'll take care of meeting my needs to some degree. We learn to value the other person's needs as highly as our own, so it isn't war anymore. And by the way, when you lower your defenses in conflict, usually the other person will too. But it's pretty scary to lower yours first. But typically that does happen. Accept your own weakness. Number F, learn new techniques to satisfy my love needs other than that symbiotic relationship of a person who dotes on you. And particularly for a lot of men, it's hard to give up the idea of wanting a woman who will dote on us. And then number G, accept the difficult work of creating a good marriage. Good marriages are just bloody hard work, in my opinion. I was talking to some people last week, and we were laughing together about being in our 20s and 30s and looking at older couples who had marriage problems and thinking, boy, that's too bad. All it means is you haven't finished growing up yet, because they come, and it's really hard work. Now, we've saved some time for discussion among the group. So with all this information we have today, what type of thing would you like to say to the church?
Well, it's not like you hit a certain point and then you quit. I mean, it seems to me like it's a continual process. So there's not a point that you get to when you've made it.
No, there's not a point to get to when you've made it. But there is a point where you realize that you don't look every time you have a need to your marriage partner and react in anger and disappointment and betrayal when they can't meet it. You're right. There's no, if anybody's arrived, write a book. You know.
Of all the people walking around, when you say the final stage is creating a good marriage, I get the impression that it's not that good a percentage that have gotten, you know, to some level. What would you say is the...
Well, I'd like some opinion of the other counselors in the group, but American statistics from researchers would indicate, from my information, that you're not looking at more than 10% of American marriages that achieve this non-symbiotic marriage.
Will you define symbiosis for us?
Again, symbiosis is the idea that it's that early 18-month-old child who's with their mom, who's having this just delightful interaction where this other person meets my needs. And that's what creates that romantic pizzazz, that flash of energy inside of me when I see this person.
Is that necessarily a two-way street?
It often is, I think.
But you're right, sometimes it isn't. I can remember, shoot, in my marriage, I was in required group therapy in graduate school, and we were talking about marriages, and I was telling everybody what a great marriage I had, and they said, it can't be that good. So I went home and asked Susie, and she told me it wasn't that good. And that's not a joke. See, I believed it. I was very depressed that night. So I went about the business of trying to convince her it was that good, which was impossible because for her it wasn't. So you're right. It isn't always. In premarital romance, it usually is, and that's the glue that holds this couple together.
So a good marriage is not necessarily finding that perfect person, but for two people that are attracted to each other to find the perfect way to solve their problems as they go along. I mean, to establish a good way to resolve issues and stuff. So the actual establishment of the relationship is more important than finding that perfect person.
Well, I think so. I come from a church background that teaches the perfect will of God for your life, which adds to that, that God has one perfect partner for you, and it's your spiritual job to find this person. Now, if I do that, isn't this person going to be my new mommy or daddy and meet all my needs? I mean, theologically, it's there. And so these kids get married, and then they're utterly disappointed. But since it's God's perfect will, it's their job to keep their mouth shut in public and tear each other apart at home to make each other the right. But I think you're very right. There's no, from my standpoint, there's no perfect marriage partner. There's the work of growing and maturing. Ralph?
Is there any point to talking to people before they get married? I mean, it seems like from what you say, if they're in this love state, then there's no, just wait till after they get married and talk to them then. Is there any point to premarital counseling?
Well, you know, that's where I opened with my own frustration at it. I think it's a little bit like somebody who buys a new car and doesn't think it's ever going to break. It's give them the warranty, you know. Give them your card, tell them to come back. Give them the books. But, you know, we can't talk people out of romance. It's just too powerful.
I think also it's hard to accept the process. I mean, I don't, in our marriage, I find that we might have reached a plateau in one area, only to have exactly the same conflict in another. And even perhaps have a repetitive one where we just go back and forth, and you'd say you'd think that after 25 years we perhaps could, since we moved up to a different plateau in one area, that now we could do it in another area, you know, get over that, that wanting somebody else to meet your needs. But I find that it's a slow process.
And I think you're very right.
And I'm not so sure it's even how much time you devote to working on it. I think it's a question of growing up. And for every person, I think that's a bit of an individual issue.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And why is it repetitive? Because the seeds of it were put in you in your first 3 years of life. And so I think we repeat this maturity process over and over as we hit new issues. And we shouldn't be down on ourselves when we move. Back in the back.
You spoke about these stages being apparent, even say with the relationship of a pastor to his church, his or her church. I would challenge that all these issues should be dealt with, or many of these issues should be dealt with, in the relationship we see our teenagers, our young children having, because you can't all of a sudden, when you reach a point where you're ready to marry, start addressing these issues and these stages in relationships if you haven't been dealing with them with your young children and teenagers, so that it's something that they can move into inherently then, you know, totally new.
Right, and how do we deal with these stages in kids? Well, we do it not by being permissive or by being over-controlling, which are the two easy responses, because if we're permissive, we give children the idea that relationships don't have boundaries, and that I can get all my stuff all the time. And if we're over-controlling, we teach them that if they just exert enough power, see, right now the power is being exerted on them by us.
But they're learning.
But they're learning, right.
then they get the idea that if they just exert enough power. But if we are parents where we have boundaries, but we don't over control and we aren't permissive, we give children the opportunity to work out that marvelous discovery that mom and dad can be good and bad in the same person. But that's really hard work because it stirs up my anxiety because I don't want to be a bad parent. And so what we tend to do is get far and close away from our kids during these same interactions. And that's why to parent, we have to finish this work in ourselves.
To take that child a little farther, you have an adult child looking perhaps with some unmet needs and going back to the parent and say, you did not do this for me when I was a child, therefore I'm unhappy now. Is that immaturity or what?
It's fairly normal. Blame doesn't help. Recognition of the problem is necessary, so it's important to be able to recognize and label what happened to us. But then for anybody over about 15, it's really their own job to finish growing up.
Kind of along with that, how do we know what those things are? I mean, in adult relationships, we see that there are conflicts when we're in relationships, but how do we know what the seeds are? Yes.
Or is it important?
Retrospect.
Is it
therapy to figure it out?
Is it important? Yes. How do we find out if you go to therapy? No. Actually, you can get lots of good therapy without going to therapists. You begin to reflect on yourself, you begin to journal, you begin to talk to trusted friends other than your spouses who will tell you honestly how you impact them and what their, you know, how your relationship is. And we begin to increase our own awareness to our feeling self, particularly for those of us who are out of touch with our feeling self. And so, yeah, we begin to push, you know, our own awareness a little wider. And it is important.
Yeah. It's actually the child's problem and not the mother's problem.
Yeah, it's the child's problem. It's all of our own problem to finish our own maturity. That's the task we were given.
How does she get that across, though?
The mother?
Yeah, the child.
Can you ask that?
Well, if the child's still looking at the mother, how did you say that beyond the age of 15, it's up to the child to continue the process? But the child keeps coming back. How do you help the child to understand that it's up to them now?
I think just out of your own selfhood, you encourage them that they have to make decisions and be aware of who they are. Process decision making with them, just like you would for yourself, rather than doing it for them or fleeing from it at a distance. This is the hard work of increasing my own awareness of who I am and what I'm looking for in this relationship. Okay, one more question and we'll end.
Is there any certain type of people that keeps coming to you who have a marriage that works? And I'm not sure what type of people, I mean, I don't know, maybe tall people. is there a pattern of a person who has a marriage, who seem to be able to have a marriage that keeps?
Big handsome pastor. I don't think there's any type of person or personality that's more successful in marriage than another. I think that the successful person in marriage is one who has come to peace with who they are and their own responsibility for their own life. So it's easier to answer another question, which is just the opposite. What's the most typical person who isn't successful in marriage? And the most typical unsuccessful people in marriage are those who really have a model of marriage as a box, where I find another person to jump in this box with who's going to make me feel and be okay.
And that approach to marriage, and that's how Harville Hendrix begins his book with that illustration. I think that type of a person is the most prone to chronic ongoing marriage disappointment. They're the most incomplete in themselves, so they look for the most completion externally, and we're always going to be disappointed. Oh, last comment.
But those people oftentimes all have a negative image of themselves, too. You
know, they're insecure.
Growing up with a very negative.
Right. That type of a person would have a negative self-image, or a language I might prefer is that they're insecure and incomplete, and so they're looking for that.
And are they also, these two needy people, are they kind of the more needy get together and the
less needy get
less together? Needy. Well, the
more
people
complete.
Who are more comfortable with themselves will find somebody else who's more comfortable with themselves. So
that's true, but not always true. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.